The following presentation was recorded live by Voices from Jerusalem.
Okay, so getting on to our topic. When talking about Judaism and feminism, the first thing that we have to do if we're going to be fair to ourselves is to define the terms that we're using. Okay, feminism has come to mean different things to different people. Taking it what it means as a word, it should mean anything that advances the cause of women, that makes things better for women. Okay, Judaism, again, has come to mean even more things to different people. But I would take it again from its own self-definition in the Torah itself. It says in the Torah that God separated us to be a godly people, okay, a holy people, a nation of priests. So in terms of what Judaism is in essence, it's the way in which we become holy. It's a path. Is this path compatible with the advancement of women? Is what we have to discuss. As much as possible, I'm going to try to keep the discussion in the framework of the Torah itself, rather than people's opinions of what the Torah says, in order that we see what Judaism actually says and not what people say. So the first place where we would have to look when discussing what does Judaism say about women would be, of course, Parshat Bereshit, the first parsha in the Torah, where we have the creation of the first woman. Okay, in the text, it begins by saying that God consulted with his angels, right? Doesn't use the words he consulted with his angels. He said he spoke to them, okay? And he said, let us make Adam in our image. Okay, you could ask, I just said a moment ago, we're going to talk about the creation of woman. Why am I talking about Adam? The reason for this is the text goes on and says, God blessed them and told them, be fruitful, plural. The word paru is plural. And multiply, plural. Revu is plural. The Talmud asks concerning this, who was God talking to after Adam was created? Who's the plural? And answers that the original Adam was androgynous, had the qualities of both sexes. So therefore, God was speaking to a person who by nature was pluralistic. Now, to understand this idea, because this is before God separated Adam into Adam and Chava, into Ish and Isha, man and woman, why would he still refer to this first being plurally? In other words, if this one person had all of the qualities of a man and a woman, it's still one person. It's not two people. Why be plural? Okay, the deeper side of this is that the very nature of what we'll call male and call female is separate enough that God chose to refer to this person who physically at that point was one in plural. Okay, now we come into the first Judaic idea. All of this was introductory. Okay, the first Judaic idea is that therefore we acknowledge that men and women are different and that the difference is good. The difference is positive. The difference is the foundation of mutual contributive effort. The more a person denies what they have to give, the less likely they are to give it. Another part of this very first assumption is that people are happy when they're actualized. The same way in nature, we observe that all animals, for instance, do everything they can do. In other words, you don't have birds that can fly but select not to fly. You know, I'm just not into it, you know. I'm an individual. Okay, I don't want a group identity. Okay, I transcend classification, right? You don't have this. Okay, you don't have grass that chooses not to photosynthesize, right? Okay, similarly, with humans, we tend to be happy when we are everything that we could possibly be. Okay, so the Torah will see that human happiness is contingent on using everything that we are. Okay, so a person who would conscientiously select to have no sexual identity at all is viewed by Judaism as having destroyed to some degree their ability to be contributive and receptive, and to some degree doomed themselves to a lack of actualization. Now, why am I throwing in this "to some degree" business? Where did that come from? In addition to being men and women, what else are we? We're also human. So self-actualization doesn't come exclusively through the expression of one's sexuality, but it does come at least partially thereby. Okay, let's go back to what happens now with the Great Division. God divides Adam into two segments, but the division doesn't take place up and down, right and left, back and forward. The division is that of the inner part, the rib, and the rest. Inner and outer. Okay, it's a very interesting way to divide. In order to understand the enormous significance of our knowing this, because we know nothing about how the world came into being from the Torah text. We have no idea how grass emerged, we have no idea how plants emerged, nothing. The significance of this is that for human beings, bodies have a unique function. They're meant to express the soul. So everything about the body is significant. Certainly when you're going back to the days of creation, the narration of how things are made is enormously, enormously significant. This is telling us the very core of who we are. Okay, so the idea of inner and outer means that she, by her nature, is going to be manifest as a human being through innerness. He, by his nature, is going to be manifest as a human being by his outerness, which I have to explain. Okay, the first thing that I have to explain before I go into the halachas that reflect this is the nature of power. Okay, when you talk about a person being powerful, what does that really mean? Someone who could control. Okay, so we'll say, for instance, that a person is powerless if they have no control over anything that has to do with their lives. We'll say a person is powerful if they not only control their life, but control the lives of others, right? Okay, so if you were to ask someone, an average person, whatever that is, who's the most powerful person in the world today? What are some answers we might get? Mandela, certainly in South Africa, Mandela is very powerful.
Clinton.
Okay, in the rest of the world, there's Clinton. But and there's also Bill. Okay, so suppose you you went sticking with Clinton, about whom I know more than I know about Mandela. Okay, so suppose he were to go back to Little Rock, where he was governor for many years. Or at least where he acted like he was governor, well, she, whatever. So suppose you were to interview people in the street, and you would ask them, which person made you the person who you are? Which person affected your life most dramatically? How many people in Little Rock would say Clinton?
None.
And if you would broaden this to the United States and ask people who made you who you are, I'm sure very few people would come down to Clinton also. Okay, so what I'm trying to illustrate to you is that judaically we see that there are two avenues of power. There's the avenue of power whereby people affect people and turn them into being what they are, and the avenue of power that has to do with the external formations of society. Okay? Now, to make this whole idea a bit trickier, a tricky part of this idea is that, as we said already, in addition to being male and female, we're also human. So that would imply that all men have some degree of what we'll call feminine nature, and all women have some degree of what we'll call male nature. Okay, now we have to talk about Judaism's responses to these things and compare it to the responses of feminism. Okay, first I have to talk to you about the nature of halacha, Halachah means literally what? What does the word mean? So I heard people say law. The word for law in Hebrew is what?
Din.
What does halacha mean?
Way.
It means the way. Now this is much deeper than law. The assumptions of law in a secular society is that the individual or the society has its own way, and the function of the law is to prevent that path from being intruded upon by outside forces. You understand this? The assumption of halacha is that the Torah itself gives us not only the ability to find a way, but it gives us the way. So I'll illustrate this concretely. In the general society, all laws are negative, basically. For instance, I don't know the traffic laws here. I would imagine there are traffic lights here as there are in other places. I haven't seen this on the way here, I must admit. I assume there are laws concerning, you know, speed. I didn't notice that either. But in any case, okay, so you'll have a law that will say, stop at the red, go at the green, right? Wrong. You'll have laws saying stop at the red, but there'll never be a law saying you have to go at the green. Go seek out a green light in order that you can go. There's never... Okay, why? Because where you want to go, how you want to live your life in secular society is left to who? To yourself. And the laws that are there are meant to be there to make it possible. Halacha is meant to be the path itself. For those of you who studied philosophy, Greek philosophy in any case, you may be familiar with Aristotle's golden mean. Then again, for those of you who didn't and don't want to know about this, that's life, I'm going to tell you anyway. Okay, his idea of the golden mean was very similar externally to Rambam's idea of also the golden path, the middle road. He says any situation in which one is able to choose what's true and not extreme in any direction is the golden mean, and that's the path you should choose. Okay, what didn't Aristotle say? He didn't say where that path will go. That was not interesting to Aristotle. That was left to the individual to determine. In Judaism, Rambam will say almost the same directions. Find truth, avoid extremity, so that you could walk the path of God. You understand the enormous difference there? So you could be a more God-like individual. So the aspect of you that you share in common with God will be more expressed. So that there'll be resolution of personal conflict and ultimately purpose in living. It's a big difference. Okay, so because of this, halacha is going to be structured different than secular law. In this, that there are positive mitzvot as well as negative mitzvot. The halacha is not only going to tell us what not to do, but it's going to tell us what to do. In addition to this, the negative laws are not just assumptions on convenience. The negative law, in terms of being effective in getting people going, the negative laws are going to be there to prevent personal self-diminishment. And therefore, they're going to affect areas of life that secular law would never affect. That's how halacha and secular law are different. Here's the area that they share in common. There's no reason to make a law unless people want to disobey the law. Do you understand what I mean by this? In other words, if all people intuitively would stop at the red light because it's the right thing to do, or drive no faster than the speed limits because that's what's morally correct, then there would be no reason for law. Okay, the assumption behind any law is that people are dualistic in their nature. They want, but they also don't want. I saw a very interesting survey. In the United States, they did a poll asking people whether they approved of traffic laws or not. Speed limits, lights, etc. What percentage of the people do you think approved of there being traffic laws? Have a guess. Close to 88%. People were then asked if they broke any traffic laws within the last year. What do you think the percentage there was? Even higher. Okay, so we want and we don't want at the same time. This is also like the good old diet syndrome. We all know that, right? Okay, in other words, if I were filling out a form, right? It So check off only one. Would you rather be thin and athletic? That's choice one. Or fat and dumpy? Okay. Choose only one. I would for sure accept thin and athletic. So who was it who ate every bit of food on the plate? Someone else? No. Okay. Okay, so all law is repressive. This is a very important thing to realize when we're discussing this. And from the perspective of Torah, repression is appropriate in terms of allowing for self-diminishment to be prevented, and not only for the convenience of society, but all law is repressive. Okay, now moving this forward. Okay, so men and women are supposed to be different. How are they supposed to be different? She conducts inner life, he conducts outer life. There's more. The Torah also tells us that the woman is meant to be an ezer kenegdo, which literally means a helper, who's either parallel or opposed to him. The word keneged means both. And Rashi says it, in fact, could mean either. If he's worthy, she'll be parallel to him. If he's unworthy, she'll oppose him. Okay, now here, I think, is the place where feminist people will find the Torah inacceptable. The premises before there, that the differences between the sexes are real, are also some things that people will find objectionable. But I'm going to stop here and move over to feminism for a moment. Okay. Why did feminism arise as a movement? So again, as we said earlier, people who are not actualized, who are not using all of their abilities and talents, are by and large not happy. Let's go back 250, or even less, 200 years to the shtetl, right? Picture this scene. Bela and Zalman are sitting by the table. Okay? Okay, Zalman says to Bela, this is in their one room, you know, with the curtain dividing the room between where the parents sleep and where everything else happens, right? Okay, so the little table is in the parents' room, dining room, living room, yeah? Says, Bela. And she says, what, Zalman? And he says, are you self-actualized? Okay. What would she say? What are you talking about? Okay, but let's say she's feeling romantic that evening. She looks across at him, right to his eyes, right? Okay, you know, she sees him, there he is, the other side of the table. His peddler sack is in the corner. Okay, Zalman, are you self-actualized? What would he say? What? Okay, so given the challenges of that society, people were doing everything they could. There was no question. These are people who got up before dawn and did tasks of enormous, enormous magnitude, the men as well as the women. Zalman was not a person who spent his day wondering about to be or not to be. Zalman was a person who was schlepping from shtetl to shtetl, selling pins, needles, and threads, right? Okay, time went on. Okay, the technological revolution took place. So now we're moving up generationally, but I'm going to keep their names Zalman and Bela until we get to our times. Then they'll become Saul and Bel. Okay, so here we are. A long time passes. We're in the 40s. Okay? Let's say right before or right after World War II, either way. Forgetting about the Holocaust and all of its consequences. Okay, how is Zalman's life different? How is his life different? He has a store. Okay? But he's still basically doing the same thing that he did. He's busy all day long, and men those days put in 12-hour days, 16-hour days. You know this from your grandparents. Okay, how was Bela's life different? She had a she may not have had a washing machine. She probably had a refrigerator. She probably had an iron that you plug in the wall. She probably had a stove. which is a lot better than what she had before. Okay, she probably had an ice box. Some of you who are older may remember what an ice box is. It's a refrigerator where people would bring the ice to it, okay? And this reduced her workload radically. So her life was beginning to be very different, and the time was getting freed up. Let's move it ahead, and things happened so quickly from that point on. Moving it ahead only another 10 years. Here we are in 1955. Again, his life is very close to what it was. Possibly he's working fewer hours, and certainly he's making more money. Her life is different. By this time, birth control had also become popularized. So odds are Bela of the 50s will have 2 children, 3 children, 5 children, unlike Bela of the shtetl. Okay, Bela of the 50s not only has an icebox, a stove, electricity, she probably could shop in a supermarket. She probably has heating that comes through other means than her going to the coal cellar. Her life is dramatically different, which freed up a lot of time. What did women do with their time in the 50s? All this time that was freed up. Okay. Oftentimes, because it's the nature of people to want to be active, they filled it up with what I'll call leisure time activity. I have to just share something with you. I have an aunt do you have Mahjong here in South Africa? Okay, Mahjong is, it's bridge. It's like a card game, but instead of cards, they use ivory tiles. Okay, it's like gin rummy, but with ivory tiles. Okay, so my aunt was an avid Mahjong player. So she used to have her friends come over every afternoon, and they would take out they had very beautiful Mahjong sets with, you know, the ivory pieces. It was very pretty. Okay, her son, my cousin, once had to write an essay for school about what do my parents do. So he thought playing Mahjong was a job. Like he didn't, you know, he was little. So I said, you know, my father is a contractor and my mother plays Mahjong for a living. And she works very hard. She's busy all afternoon, every day. She, even when she's not well, she's still, you know. So many women fill their time up with leisure time activities. The problem is those activities are not very actualizing. They don't use the mind, they don't use the emotions, and they don't use the body. And those are the 3 things that we have. So this, by the nature of things, slowly created a certain level of discontent. Now, there were women who made other choices. There were women who did charity work. There were women who took careers, but they were the minority in those years. Okay, by the time the 60s and 70s rolled around, you had large numbers of women who had no idea of what they're supposed to be doing with their lives to give it meaning. Okay. Now this, in the United States, was made even more difficult by the fact that the middle class by that point had moved out to the suburbs. So that meant everyone lived in their own house as opposed to tenements, apartment buildings. So not only were the women doing things that didn't give an enormous amount of fulfillment all day long, they were doing it alone. Okay? So Saul, now he's Saul, okay, was out in his office all day. And Belle was out in her house in the suburbs, which did not take more than 2 hours a day to clean. And her children went to school, and there were only 3 of them. And that's an awful long time for playing Mahjong. Okay, so people, of course, there are all sorts of ways to fill time, but they're not actualizing. Okay, so this is the vacuum that feminism came into. I have to tell you the least surprising part of it. The least surprising part of feminism in my eyes is that the early founders were all Jewish. Okay, why? Because it's not the nature of Jews to want to do this with their lives. It's very antithetical to what Jewish life is about. So what did they do? And here's where Torah and feminism will part ways. That since being a woman is not fulfilling, what's another possibility? be a man. Okay? So early feminism, first stage feminism, which is becoming more and more passé, was a movement basically to allow women the freedom not to be themselves, but to be men. Now, here's the problem with having the freedom to be something that you aren't. It represses the part of you that wants to be who you are. This is a major problem. Now, there's one other problem that has to be stated, because I would imagine this is real in South Africa as well. In addition to the enormous time block that was freed up for women, another thing was taking place. The values of Zalman and Bela in the shtetl were not the values of Sal and Bela in the suburbs. The values of Zalman and Bela were much closer to what are you in the world for? You're here to fix yourself, you're here to fix the world. The values of the suburbs, at least in the United States, are you're here in the world to make money and have pleasure. Okay, things that men do, what Sal would do in the office all day would bring in money. What Belle would do in her little suburban house did not bring in money. Status went with money. So women also suffered the enormous pain of feeling statusless. To the point where anything feminine was viewed as somehow integrally insignificant, and anything male was viewed as significant. Now, because the external society is this way, even in the religious world, sometimes I find women apologizing for being women. I've seen people ask women with large families, 9 children, 10 children, do you work? Forget about what the answer is. What does the question mean? You know, do they just sort of be like Topsy and Uncle Tom? I mean, what does that mean? Okay, do you lie on the sofa all afternoon and eat sugar-coated almonds? I mean, what does this mean? Okay? What this means, of course, is do you earn money or not? And this is something that gives women a feeling not only of not being expressed, but of not being in control and of not having any status. So as I said, the early remedy was so be a man. Okay, live in a man's world. This wasn't satisfying to many people for 2 obvious reasons. Okay, the first one, the most obvious reason, is that you can't be what you aren't and be happy. The other reason is more subtle. When I was a teenager, I used to read black publications. What could I tell you? I was interested in that. So it was a publication called Ebony. So at one point, I saw ads for hair straighteners in Ebony. Okay, today in the United States, that would be unlikely to happen in a black publication, even though some black people do use hair straighteners. The reason for this is that black self-esteem has risen enough that they aren't spending their time with the hair straighteners, and they also used to have skin lighteners, which I haven't seen. Okay, they aren't wasting their time with skin lighteners because it's okay to be who you are. Okay, women were not content with first stage feminism, both because they couldn't be men even if they wanted to, and the ones who succeeded often found a certain frustration in this that they still weren't who they wanted to be. Okay, which takes us to second stage feminism, the idealization of the superwoman. So the superwoman is the woman who has it all. She's totally expressed in the man's world, and she's totally expressed in the woman's world. That's the kind of feminism I grew up with. Okay, what's the problem with superwoman feminism?
To be exhausted by the end of the day.
Okay, not only exhausted, but it's not going to happen. Okay, so it's sort of like spending your whole life seeking to meet an impossible goal. It's frustrating, and it is impossible. Okay, in the United States, the decision was made collectively, because the government there does represent the people, that since it is impossible to be superwoman, then you have to be career woman primarily and anything else secondarily. The workplace does not offer part-time work. The corporate ladder doesn't make any allowance for raising children at all. Okay. Now, here's where this gets political on my part, and the ones who pushed through those laws were women who view themselves as feminist. It's the feminist lobby that would not allow two-track work systems, because they saw the liberation of women being contingent not only on adapting a male role, but on also rejecting a female role. Now we'll go back to Judaism. What's the path? The path in Judaism is that there has to be vehicles of self-expression for your feminine side, just as there is for every other side of yourself. And to create those paths, there are going to be negative laws, which are going to be repressive, because all negative law is repressive, and positive law, which is going to be expressive, because all positive law is expressive. Okay, one more thing has to be thrown into the works before we get into the specific laws. Everything I said until now from Chumash, from the Bible, is from before the sin of Adam and Chava. Before the sin, there was evil in the world because God created humans with the possibility of overcoming and rectifying. If there's nothing to rectify, there's no reason for there to be a world. But it was outside. What do I mean by outside? Again, you're driving on the highway. There are two road signs, exit 54, exit 62. You could clearly see what they both are and choose one of them. Similarly, before the sin, it was very clear to people, to Adam and Chava, what they were choosing. They had the ability to choose this or to choose that. They could choose evil, but it was very clear. After the sin, evil became part of us, so we don't see clearly. It's part of our minds, it's part of our emotions, and it's part of our bodies. So things are worse and more complicated. Now we could talk about what the laws are. Okay, so again, some of this will be expressive, and again, to purify it and to prevent diminishment, some of it will be repressive. Let's start with mind. What do we view as specifically feminine about the mind? The ability to be understanding and empathetic. This is called bina. In the text, the verb that's used for the creation of woman is vayiben, which means literally, and he built, meaning Hashem built her. But the word bina is also related to the word livnot. Therefore, the Talmud says he gave her an extra measurement of bina, of understanding. So here's what this doesn't mean. It doesn't mean men have no understanding and women have all the understanding. It means that women have a greater amount of understanding than men. Okay, what are some offshoots of this? Okay, so the first offshoot that you may be familiar with is that women are not rabbis. Now, this is an interesting offshoot of understanding. What? Okay, the way we use the word rabbi today is usually to mean a communal leader, someone who speaks before the public, somebody who leads them spiritually. What are some other functions of a rabbi? Teaching. So somebody finally said it. Last but not least, I finally heard this boy answering questions in halacha. Okay. So today, that's usually like number 10 on the list or so amongst the other jobs. And in non-Orthodox Judaism, it could be much, much further down on the list. As a matter of fact, it could not be on the list. Okay. What list? Anyway, but the halachic definition of rabbi is somebody who answers halachic shilas. If he also does everything else, that's wonderful. But the primary purpose of there being a rav is, this is what it'll say on the smicha paper. On a good smicha paper, it says, yoreh yoreh, which means he shall surely teach. And what's the next phrase? Don't know. Yadin, yadin, he shall surely judge. Okay, in order to judge according to Torah law, the judge is forbidden to judge the person and only permitted to judge the deed. So if you have two instances of theft, for instance, one in which the person was really at the end of their tether and had had a terrible childhood and was pushed over the edge by somebody who's very insensitive, who was showing off their possessions, what is that in halacha still called? Theft. And that's not, in terms of the psak, that's not any different than somebody who steals just for the fun of stealing. You understand this?
There's no looking at the person. There's looking at the reality. Why do you think in judging we're forbidden to look at personal circumstances? Because in the end it will make law totally relativistic, as it has in the United States, and subjective. And also because there's an assumption that we have no right to judge people. We don't even try to judge people. So we aren't judged. The end of a p'sak din isn't you're good, you're bad, you're a nice person, you're an icky person. Okay, the end is you're obligated to pay the fine and you're not. It has to do with obligation. Clear? Okay, a person who's understanding and empathetic is supposed to develop their ability to always see the person. It's something to be worked upon. Why is it important in a society to have someone who understands humans? Okay, so the premise is you can't build people without understanding. It doesn't work. I'll give you an illustration of this. A number of years ago, there was this... I was going to take you back to something that was distant. Even recently, in the United States, many crimes that are committed by children. Do you know this? Kids of 14, 15. To the point where I was reading an article about the gun lobby, the lobby of people who will always rally to Congress to prevent there being laws against carrying weapons. Okay, there are 170,000 gun licenses. These are licensed guns. Okay, that are given to children, and I'm using the word children because that's really what they are, between the ages of 15 and 20. They take them to high school. They don't take them to high school to do mitzvot. Okay, that's nobody... Okay, and this includes automatic weaponry. This is... Okay. Okay, there's something wrong in a society in which that large a number of children are violent or potentially violent. What's wrong? Amongst the things that are wrong is that nobody is spending time and effort building humans. In the Sunday supplement of the New York Times 2 weeks ago, they had an article about this very topic and a solution. Are you ready for the solution? Teaching human values should be a subspecialty in teacher's college. In other words, they've given up on the idea of people transmitting values in their homes. It's not going to happen. So they want to have a subspecialty of teachers learning for X amount of time, a course in transmitting values. But the Civil Liberties Union immediately protested this for the reasons that you just said. Whose values will they be teaching? Who said that those values are genuine? So what's the solution as of this moment? Don't teach any values. Okay? It's a good solution if you want a society like the one that America is turning out to be. Okay, so... The reason why a woman can't be a rabbi is she's meant to use the empathetic side of herself. She's meant to see the whole picture. She's meant to see the whole person. She's meant to be empathetic with the people who are standing before her rather than detached and subjective. Another thing that's important to understand also is that according to Jewish law, we aren't worried about justice being done. We don't think we could judge people, and we're not worried about justice being done. Could humans do justice? Of course not. Okay, so suppose Hitler were to be found living in Brazil. Okay? So what would happen next? Israel would extradite him, and there'd be this big show trial in Jerusalem, and in the end he'd probably be executed. And then could anybody say, okay, now justice has been done? Of course not. Of course not. Even if you would have been found 40, 50 years ago, nobody could say that. Why? Because the enormity of what he did goes beyond human justice. So we aren't worried about this, that we're going to not be just. We're worried about doing what the law demands. This is clear? It's a completely different approach. In addition to not being rabbis, what are some other things that women don't do? Women don't witness in court, although in contemporary court situations, by and large, that isn't the case. Okay, in theory, women don't witness, and the reason for this is, again, the purpose of the witness isn't to do anything but to describe the situation, and not anything that goes around the situation. Contemporarily, in court situations, by and large, we don't have formal witnessing, and by and large, women do give testimony. Okay. Shchita, women. Well, actually, in Sephardi communities, women do shchita, which I think is interesting. Certainly in Yemenite communities, and certainly with small animals such as chickens. Okay, but even according to the opinion that women shouldn't do shchita, what's the opinion? That women are incapable of it? Have you all seen shchita of a chicken? Is it a very complicated affair? No. It's not the complication. What is it? Is that for her to hold the knife steadily and to do it unhesitatingly may be against a part of her nature that she shouldn't be opposing. In other words, could she oppose the nature successfully? Yes. Is it good for anyone? Not necessarily. Okay, what are some other things that women don't do? Laying tefillin. Okay? And I'll include in laying tefillin all of the arena of public prayer ritual. Okay, this will include tefillin, talus, tzitzis, being a chazan, reading from the Torah, being counted in a minyan. Okay, now, I'm going to depart from our main topic, which is women and feminism, and, you know, like, and the feminine side of it, the feminist side of it, and move on to men. Are you all ready for something radical? Anyone here with a weak card? Men also have a place in Judaism. How do you like that? Okay. I mean, again, this isn't for everyone to hear, but men really do have, you know. So the same way women are actualized through using their specific capacities to contribute to the society and to express themselves, men also have something to contribute that has meaning. As we said, men tend to be more externally self-developed. They tend to define societally as opposed to individually more than women. Hence the Talmud says that even 1,000 women are never a tzibor, a community. They're always 1,000 women. They're always 1,000 individuals who look at people individually. This is, we observe this in this that men tend to form little groups and teams. Okay, so there are the sports teams, and then there's the legal teams, and then there's the military teams. They like forming teams. They like wearing uniforms, right? They like group identity. Is there something, even though I've been very patronizing, if there was a man in the audience, I could picture him throwing something at me. Okay, but in any case, they're also more aggressive. But, okay, forming a group identity is an important thing. The same way women individuate and therefore create individuals, men tend to collectivize and therefore determine the life of the collective. If that need to find identity in group is not used in synagogue life, does it go away? No. It ends up invested in what? In things that don't do what we're here for, which is, again, to rectify oneself and rectify the world. Synagogue life is good for men. It's as it should be. Okay? And I want you to observe something else. In other religions, such as Christianity, in which there isn't this sharp division of men and women running the show in communal life, who attends the services? Women. The reason why men don't attend the services is by and large because they don't feel their place there. You understand this? Okay, it's good for men to have that aspect of public life, and it's not good for women to take it away. Why isn't it good to take away? If we're here to be contributive and helpful, taking away somebody's vehicle of self-actualization is neither contributive nor helpful. In addition to this, when you take away that which is someone else's, one tends to neglect what? That which is one's own. Okay, so this will include all of the things. I'm not even going to deal with them individually because they all fall under this of collective. Or external, such as tefillin. Okay, now an interesting thing here is that for various reasons, I don't know South Africa well enough to see whether this would be the case here to the same degree. In the United States, when people are not observant, even though they're religious, because there's a difference between religious and observant, they tend to attend the synagogue at least a number of times a year. So they may not keep Shabbos, they may not keep kosher, they certainly don't go to the mikveh, but they do go to the synagogue. So for people who attend Reform and conservative synagogues, they'll draw the conclusion that women have no place in Judaism because the only place that they're familiar with is synagogue life. Okay, in fact, if you were to ask somebody, are you from, are you really observant, and they say yes, what would you assume about their behavior? What mitzvot would you assume that that would include? Shabbos, kashrus, mikveh, more. Where do those mitzvahs live? At home. You understand this? So the fact that women feel disincluded is because, for various reasons that are often not in their control, Judaism has been removed from the home. So of course they don't see women included because they've excluded themselves. It may not be their fault that they've excluded themselves, but they have. Now this is coupled by this, that in the society in which we live, everything masculine is somehow viewed as more important. I had a student who sent me a friend of hers. So here I was in my kitchen Friday morning, there's a knock on the door, a woman comes in. She says, I'm a friend of Susie, I'm from California, so I invite her to sit down. So I asked her, what brings you to Israel? So she said, I'm here for 2 weeks because I decided to explore my Jewish roots more thoroughly. And she tells me that she had in fact begun expressing this interest back home to her Reform rabbi. So she, on her own initiative, asked this Reform rabbi, what mitzvah do you think I should begin with? I want to do something that will create connection. What mitzvah did the rabbi choose? What mitzvah would you choose? Kashrut is a good place. Shabbos is a good place. The rabbi encouraged her to buy a talis. Okay, which she showed me. She had it in her bag, a very beautiful hand-woven talis, which with the tzitzis of which were probably puzzled, but that's another story. Okay, but now, what I want to tell you is that, especially young Reform rabbis, the rabbi probably didn't know better either. It isn't that the rabbi was the bad guy in the story. What does she know? Okay. She's just a well-meaning person with a strong Jewish identity. She doesn't have a clue about Shabbos, Kashrus, or anything from personal experience. Her picture of women in Judaism is based on their exclusion from public life. Okay, moving further. Another thing that we observe, not only from what women don't do. Well, actually, do you have any more things that women don't do that you would want to talk about?
Don't say Kaddish.
Don't say Kaddish, what? I can't hear you.
Time or anything.
Time. Oh, time. Okay, yeah. Okay. So women don't do the mitzvot that have a strong time bond. Okay. So the idea of time is also is also something that has to be explored. It'll come down to this, that women have a lot more authority over what they do with their time and less structure. They don't have to be in the synagogue 3 times a day. They have to study what they want to study, what they need to progress in life, rather than a rigid curricula of study that would include the whole Talmud. What's that for? So again, the idea is as follows. In building people, you don't need time structures, and you don't need external structures. Okay, so the reason, the world of divrei rishus, which means the world of areas in which you maintain your own authority, does that mean that there are no Jewish values? No. There are values, but you have to put them in place according to your capacity, depending on where you are in life. So if a woman chooses to go to the synagogue three times a day, she can. You asked about saying Kaddish. That again has to do with the public life of the synagogue, which is a more complicated issue. If a woman wants to study extensively, she can. Is she obligated to? No. Are there areas of study in which women have been actively discouraged from? Yes. Why? Because those will be the ones that are more oriented towards detachment. The ones that are more oriented towards attachment are ones that women have been encouraged in. In addition to this, you're probably familiar with all of the modesty laws. What are they for? Okay, so people erroneously think that their exclusive purpose is protection, and therefore, that's a partial purpose, and therefore we'll often say, well, it's his problem, why do I have to change how I dress? Right? Okay, I was just in California. In Los Angeles, they're having a billboard campaign. I was surprised that this was even legal. I couldn't believe what I was seeing. They have this blah, I don't know. All I could say is a picture of the name Lucy Lamar, and this is who you will see on this poster. You know, blonde, buxom, wearing almost nothing. It says above her, just her, yeah, and it says Angeline on top, and underneath there's a phone number. So I thought that when I saw this, I thought it was a movie. No, you call up and you get her. Okay. It's for a call girl. Okay, so, and yeah, it seems she has like a whole business with many other women who work for her. So let's say no one ever calls the number, which is unlikely to be the case in Los Angeles, but let's say, okay, well, is what she did good for her anyway? You understand the question? Forget about the protective side. She's off somewhere else. You could only reach her by phone, and let's say no one phones. Is what she did good for her? Why not? Because she defined herself in a way that's extremely limiting, exploitable, and leads to repression of her higher self. You could see this? So this is even in a situation in which there's no protection issue. The premise in all of the modesty laws is that they'll give the woman the freedom to be expressed in a way that her better side, her more dignified side, her more eternal side comes forward. Most people have no trouble with the premise of tznius. People have troubles with the halachas of tznius. You can see this? Okay, so I want to throw another premise at you, which is, our sense of normal or abnormal is formed by what age?
Four.
Okay, so in the psychological community there's disagreement, but it's certainly somewhere between the ages of 3 and 7. Nobody says older than 7. Okay, if we grew up in a society in which women don't dress modestly, will modest dress seem normal to us? No. So forget about normality being on its agenda. It's not going to happen. Not only isn't it going to happen, but if we seek to define modest dress by the norms of society, there's an inherent assumption that society's got it right. Okay, so if women were treated with maximum dignity, if their role was one that they viewed and others viewed as worthy of preservation, If femininity didn't need a defense, then you could say, all right, that society seems to be doing okay. If you could look at contemporary society in which women are freely objectified and say, I want to project myself the way that's normal in that society, then there's something wrong with your expectations. In other words, if the tznius laws fit the society we have, then there would be something wrong with the tznius laws. Just as if you were to have laws against violence, but the results would be a violent society, you would have to say the halachas have got to be different than this. Another thing about societal normality is that it's always changing. When I went to high school, there was a book that was very popular then by Salinger, Catcher in the Rye, okay, which I wanted to read. So in those days, the way a teenage girl would get Catcher in the Rye would be to go to the bookstore after having put on lipstick, and to lie about one's age, and to get the book, right? Okay, now it's on the reading lists. Okay? And it's not the worst book on the reading list. There's much worse than that that's on the reading list. Okay, so I'm not talking about whether censorship is good or censorship is bad. But what I am saying is that what's normal today will not necessarily be normal tomorrow. Okay, to the point that even things that today we say, we live in a fairly moral society without snees, without all this halacha. You give me an example of something that you would say society still preserves. Sport, yes. Okay, so there's still some values that society preserves. What are some values that society still preserves?
In South Africa, the family society still exists very strongly.
Right. So in South Africa, the family is still valued very strongly. Could you see where this is true? Could you see where South Africa, at least on some level, is making leaps and bounds and becoming more and more like America? Okay. Is it possible for you to envision a South Africa 20 years down the road in which divorce is normal? Normal, like it's just as likely to stay married as to not stay married. Okay. In America, it's just as likely for marriage to end in divorce as it is not to end in divorce. So I'm not talking about stigmatization. Stigmatization of a divorce was never a good thing. I'm just talking about normal expectations. So that in the United States, when women marry, they don't necessarily expect it to last. Because it's statistically more likely that it won't. Which makes it less easy. Okay. So if you're looking to society for standards of tznius, don't expect to find much. Another thing that has to be said in this entire discussion, not just with tznius, is the Jews were always different. Okay, the very name Ha'ivri that's given to Avraham, what does that mean? The one from the other side. Okay. Avraham coming from the other side means what? So the Gemara says the whole world was on one side, and he was on the other side. So in terms of how we view our sexuality, our capacity for contribution, the value of family, the value of modesty, it's not relevant if we're on one side and the world is on the other side. Adrabah, even more so, in an era such as our era, preserving is much more important than it ever was before. Okay, not apologizing is very important. What do I mean by not apologizing? Part of what's sort of come in the back door is women apologizing for being mothers of families, women apologizing for not being whatever 24-hour day allows them to be. A rabbi was speaking to a large audience in the United States, and a feminist in his audience got up and said, "Well, you're there on the podium. Where's your wife? Is she home cooking fish?" So he answered by saying, "No, my wife actually is a professional." So she says, "What does she do?" So she's the executive director of a group home for unwanted children, which she runs totally on her own. She has no one above her. Okay, so the woman was satisfied, and then his honesty got the better of him. And he said, "It's actually my house." So someone said, "Well, what do you mean unwanted children?" She says, "You don't know our kids. If she didn't want them, nobody would want them." Okay. But we've reached a point where it sounds so much better to do one than it does the other. So the way out of this is to stop apologizing. That's enormously important. We have to stop apologizing. How do people apologize? "Oh, see, you could be like this and also be like that. You could have, you know, the 'you could have it all' has certainly found its foot in the door with us as well." Okay, it's important for us to let go of it and to be pleased with who we are in order that we could be actualized. Okay, now I'll stop for questions, especially questions on specific laws. Yes, that's an important issue. Okay, the issue is the issue of aguna. No, thank you. Okay, so there are two things that I have to say just by prelude. This isn't my answer. This is just a prelude to the answer. It's a problem that, for various reasons, is discussed more than it occurs, which is an interesting thing. In Israel, there was, the Knesset is always discussing. That's the nature of the Knesset anyway. But the Knesset was just in another phase of discussing. And one of the left-wing members of the Knesset said, "Do you know there are 24,000 agunot in Israel?" Okay, so this made the papers. Okay, one of the, not even one of the right-wing religious party members, one of the members of Mizrahi, decided to investigate using a computer in the Ministry of Religions, which is where the divorce papers are filed, to discover how many divorces are actually pending. Now, to narrow this, he said pending for within a period of time, okay? How many do you think there really were? Pending for 5 years or so. Guess a number. 480. Okay. So there's an agenda here. Okay. Now that doesn't mean that those 480 people are not deserving of solutions. This is what I'm saying. This is not an answer. This is a prelude to an answer. But there's a reason why these exaggerations will take place. The reason why these exaggerations will take place is an agenda to create a situation of divorce by demand, right? Where if either side wants out, they could have out. This is the case in the United States. I don't know what the divorce laws are here. Whether you could have could you have unilateral divorce in South Africa? Uh-huh. Okay, whatever. In the United States, a consequence of unilateral divorce has been the following archetypical divorce situation. It's not she's married to a cruel husband who beats her and gets out. It's that he's around 45, quote, falls in love, unquote, with Lolita, his secretary, okay, who happens to be half his wife's age, leaves her and marries Lolita. Okay, statistically, that's where unilateral divorces have been going. Who's victimized by this? Women. And I would say in this instance, both women. The wife is a victim and Lolita is also a victim. Okay, so unilateral divorces don't work in terms of preserving women's rights, which is an important thing to notice. Okay, now down to the meat of it. Okay, the laws concerning aguna are assumptions that in an honest society, divorce will be bilateral. Meaning, if there's truly no love in a marriage, neither side will want to stay married. Okay? By and large, this is the case. When only one side wants out, the Rabbanim will not grant a divorce. Now, this isn't only the case where the woman wants out and the man doesn't, but it's also if the man wants out and the woman doesn't. They aren't allowed to force her to receive the get. So sometimes a problem that one hears of less is the following problem. This is a true story. My husband has a friend who's a carpenter, which in Israel makes good money. It's probably better money there relatively than it is here. But it's not like being a millionaire industrialist. Okay? He married a woman. Okay? Couldn't get on with her. He had no grounds against her. I'm not talking about something in which there are colorful and interesting grounds. He just happened to hate her. Okay, if you knew her, you would understand. Okay, she's extraordinarily beautiful. She's very, very difficult. Okay, after, how many years were they married? After around 5 years of marriage, he could not bear it any longer. So he took her to the Beit Din for divorce. The dayanim asked him if he had grounds. He had no grounds. So they said, sure, if she also wants a divorce, no problem. So she said, of course, if there's no love in the marriage, why stick with it? All I want is a divorce and the house and the child and the car and a large financial settlement, and then there's no problem. Okay? Basically, the only thing he was able to negotiate her down from was the car. Okay? He ultimately, for financial reasons, had to leave Israel. because he remarried and there was no way he could meet her financial demands and support a second family. So this is a shoe that's worn on both feet. Now, there is an exception to this. Okay, sometimes the rabbis, who could never force a woman to accept a divorce, could grant a man permission to marry a second wife. Okay, so he's still married to the first wife and still has obligations to support her, etc., etc. So he isn't gaining that much. Okay, when is this sort of permission granted? It's granted in situations where the woman is so, out of it mentally, okay, that she can't receive a divorce technically, that she, that she doesn't understand what's happening. Okay, however, to get this sort of technical permission to get a second wife, and believe me, not too many women are interested in being somebody else's second wife, right? Okay, especially imagine if, she suddenly feels better, they cure whatever she has, she's still there, yeah? Okay, even if many women were interested in being somebody else's second wife, which I can't imagine happening, for this permission to be granted, the court has to get 100 rabbanim who are not all from the same place, they have to come from different cities, to investigate the case separately and to agree. Now, I don't know about the rabbinical situation here in South Africa, but in Israel, it's hard for me to imagine 100 rabbanim agreeing that the sky is blue. Okay, but it's there on the books, but in terms of it being a practical solution, it's not a practical solution for anyone, really. Okay, the aguna problem is only solvable with people who are going to be more straightforward about what's happening to their marriage. In terms of solution, because people are not straightforward, so even though the halacha said yes, people should be, the fact is they're not, the rabbanim are working on solutions towards this. Okay, one solution is making a separate document, not part of the marriage contract, but a separate one in which they agree that in the event of the dissolution of the marriage, they'll go to a rabbinical court or else, and if not, pay a very large fine, an impossibly large fine. But in terms of wording it so that it's binding and finding courts that will deal with it, this is not a simple thing at all. But it isn't something that's not dealt with. In Israel, where the rabbanim have more power than they do here, I would imagine in a technical sense, the possibility of putting a man in jail if he won't grant a get, taking away his passport, etc., these are all done. But as I said, usually the whole aguna thing is just money. It's just like the sides bargaining against each other for settlement.
But that's not the only aguna. What about the wife whose husband disappears?
So this is what I'm saying. There are women like this. It's very rare nowadays for someone to just disappear. You understand? So I'm saying even in war, it's people don't just disappear. Okay, 90% of the disappearances are men who left wherever they are on purpose because they don't want to give their wives a financial settlement. And this takes us back to the negotiating side of it. Okay, no doubt there are some tragedies. Okay, but the laws are not as simple as one thinks. So I'll give you an example of this. When we were living in the north, the kibbutz, wasn't a kibbutz, a moshav shitufi that was near us, had this tragedy happen. During the Yom Kippur War, they had an ammunition truck. And they're not allowed to do this in the army, but they did it for convenience anyway. They had men also sitting on the ammunition. So the truck was hit, and there were no bodies. So technically, this is like, this is a case where there's no body, no clear identity, but for the halacha, this the people saw who got on the truck was good enough. Okay, so it's very rare for people to disappear unless they want to disappear. It could happen, and I'm not saying that there are no tragedies, or that there are no recalcitrant husbands or wives who won't give a divorce or take a divorce no matter what. In Israel, there was a famous Yemenite man. He just died this year. They put him in jail, and he was there, I think, for 30 years. Something like that. More even, I don't remember. And I mean, talking about cutting your nose to spite your face, you know. And this is in Israel, where a life sentence is 25 years. Okay, he was in longer than a life sentence, but he wouldn't give his wife a get. Okay, but most people are not like that. I remember the day he died, my students came and said, he died. So I said, who died? Yechya. And everyone knew which Yechya we meant.
But
so even the Dakar, okay, so even then there was record as to who actually was on the submarine. So they do have to wait a long amount of time to be sure that there were no survivors, to be sure that the submarine wasn't captured. It's a very complicated issue. But it's not oh, nobody equals no, you know, like no freedom. It's not as simple as that, because there are laws in which various forms of testimony are accepted. It's not always the case that that would be good enough.
If one can do something that's said or more, they're not obliged to, but they can. Are they actually forbidden from doing that lame tefillin, or that the one two fish they are actually forbidden?
So with tefillin, the issue was like this, that in ancient times, men wore tefillin all day long, right? Okay, and there are a record of women wearing tefillin as well. It says Michal, Shaul's daughter, wore tefillin, and that the Chachamim didn't protest. Okay, today, men only, by and large, except for a few, you know, Rav Scheinberg, people on this level, okay, men by and large only wear tefillin when they daven. The reason for this is that in wearing tefillin, there's the positive commandment to put them on, but there's also a negative commandment, which is not to desecrate God's name. It's considered a desecration to let your mind wander while wearing tefillin. So therefore, Rabbanim have said, in our times, to wear tefillin, except when it's obligatory, is more likely to lead to a sin than to a mitzvah. And therefore, they'll say no one should wear tefillin as an additional act, only when absolutely obligated. And this would apply to men as well. There's a minority opinion that in which they would say men could wear and should wear tefillin all day, but that's such a minority opinion that it's not even worth contending with. And that what I'm saying with tefillin would hold true with all of the, you know, the few things that women really, really don't do, that it'll always come down to this: what's gained by their doing it isn't worth what's lost by their not doing it. The same would hold true by and large for learning Gemara. It's a joke to say today women don't learn oral law. Every time a woman learns Chumash with Rashi, she's learning oral law. But to learn Gemara in the style of the Talmud, which is all analytical, it's 90% halacha and only 10% everything else. It's not going to develop in her what has to be developed, and the loss of that isn't worth the gain of the other. But it's not forbidden. So it's a custom, not a halacha. And the custom is based on this, that men have a clearer obligation towards Havdalah in general than women do, even though women also have an obligation. In terms of which is a biblical commandment and which is a rabbinic commandment, there's consensus that for women, it's probably only a rabbinic commandment. So because of that, men are favored in making Havdalah, meaning if there's a man available, he should make Havdalah. If there isn't a man available, since according to most women certainly have some degree of obligation, a woman could make Havdalah and drink the Havdalah wine. Then there's the superstition that she'll grow a beard. Well, I'll give you an answer to half your question. He's obliged to bring parnasa. Enough? You show me a man who brings enough. It's his response. That's what he signed on the dotted line and in the ketubah. So the way it works sociologically now is different than how it ever worked before. Mm-hmm. Kollel is a new thing. 100 years ago in Europe, no one learned, very few people learned in Kollel. Okay, the reason why it's the generally accepted practice today that when a young man finishes yeshiva at, you know, and gets married at 21, 22, he'll learn another few years, 4 years, 5 years, more, less, whatever, is coming from two places. One is that we're in such bad shape. We're in such enormously bad shape. In South Africa, you don't know how bad shape we're in. In the United States, there's a very high assimilation rate in terms of intermarriage. Okay, we're in very bad shape. So anybody who could learn really should learn. And not only should learn, but has to be an exemplary Jew in all regards. And we'll have to ultimately either teach or give tzedakah so others will. So this is an exceptional situation for our post-Holocaust reality. And it's a morality issue for a person to say, well, I'll just be ordinary. In these times, is like passing a burning building and saying, look, I'm not a fireman. You understand this? You have no... Today there's a different level of responsibility. In addition to this, because technology has freed up so much time for women, there are women who would want to work out of the house because they don't know what to do with themselves anyway, certainly at the beginning of marriage. So let's say a girl of 19 or so, Beis Yaakov girl, gets married. She doesn't have children yet. She just got married. What should she do all day? Are we back to Mahjong? You know, like, what should she do? So there are no kids to take around in the South African equivalent of carpool that I forgot how you call it here. What? Lift schemes, right? She doesn't have to deal with lift schemes. So what should she do all day? So there's no reason rationally why in this world situation she shouldn't work and let him study. Move it up another 3 years. Let's say she has children, right? Okay, at this point, if they can get by with whatever the kolel gives, plus whatever she could earn part-time, and she wants to, then why not? But the primary responsibility, bottom line, is going to be whose? His. Which is why what you observe 15 years down the line, who's usually the one who's earning the money primarily? He is.
You have been listening to Voices from Jerusalem. For a complete listing of our cassettes, see our web store at aish.com. For a free cassette catalog, email us at voices@aish.com or call toll-free in the U.S. 1-800-VOICES-3. Our main office is at 1 Western Wall Plaza, Jerusalem, Israel. Shalom from Jerusalem.